Nothing on this podcast is intended as legal advice, nor does it create an attorney-client relationship. Please be advised that this podcast also contains spoilers and swears. Welcome to Murder, She Woke, a podcast about commies, QAnon, and creepy stage managers. I'm your host, Elizabeth.
And I'm your other host, Laura.
Laura, can you believe it? It's episode 10. We made it.
I didn't expect us to get this far, and I'm sure no one else expected that either.
I definitely didn't expect it, mostly because I didn't think that people would want to listen to us talk for 10 episodes, but apparently people do, so joke's on them, I guess.
Yeah, y'all need to get a hobby.
Listening to us does not count as a hobby. But that being said, we had said in our last episode that we're going to be taking a hiatus through like the first week of August, so Laura can be a responsible adult and I can go on vacation. Hopefully you'll have to do without us. We're also working on kind of actually getting a social media presence together so that we can get even more people involved in this nightmare fuel that we call fever dream. I like that one better. Before we get started, and before we, you know, leave you guys hanging for an entire month, how are things at the ranch? And by the ranch, I mean, I assume you live on a ranch.
Oh no, I don't live on a ranch.
Metaphorical ranch.
Oh, okay. So things at the ranch are great. Work has been super busy for the last few weeks, which is unusual for me. So that's kind of, it's been fun because I like my work and I like my job, but also it's, you know, 10 and 12 hour days, which is getting old, and it's really cutting into my extracurricular activities such as podcasting and,
I know, you know, right?
Playing tennis and studying for the pimp.
Then I'm a motherfucking PI.
So how have things with you been?
I told you about that incident that I can't discuss for legal reasons.
Correct.
So basically what ended up coming out of that incident is that I made a new enemy and a new friend. His name is Mike. He's actually my lawyer. You know, we are also like kind of the same age and like we like all the same stuff, so we just like talk about history. And then he and I actually worked with the same judge, 10 years apart though.
Oh wow.
He's a baby lawyer, and he wrote this lawsuit complaint that got featured on the local news, and he sent me a link to it, and he's like, this is, you know, my firm's really excited about this. And he sends me a text like 10 minutes later, and he says, I just found a typo. And I told him, I was like, that's it. Your career is over. You're fired. You're disbarred. That is the end. Now that everything is awkward, do you want to discuss our 10th anniversary episode, season 1, episode 10, Death Takes a Curtain Call?
Yes, I would love to discuss this. Opening scene is Jessica serving Ethan pie. He is trying to get this pie and Jessica is kind of getting distracted, and Ethan just wants his pie. Jessica's getting distracted by the television, something about the Boston Ballet. They're performing with Russians. And then someone that I have lovingly dubbed as Marjorie Taylor Greencoat, she comes on the television and she's all like, fuck commies, ban the ballet, get Russia out of here.
For those of you who are fortunate enough not to know, Marjorie Taylor Greene is a freshman congresswoman from North Georgia who has made quite a name for herself in recent months. How would you describe her to somebody who is lucky enough not to know her or of her?
God, I really want to watch my words because I'm afraid she might sue me.
Oh boy.
So, yeah.
$1 billion.
She is a theme. I'm trying to just be very factual here.
As long as you know, but if you stay away from the facts and just couch in opinions, then she can't sue you because it's not a factual allegation. So if you say like she's the craziest fucking person I've ever heard of, then she can't sue you because that's an opinion.
Right. Okay. So in my opinion, she is a woman and she hasn't specifically said she's a member of QAnon, but she has, in my opinion, very strong ties with QAnon. She's a huge Trump supporter. She has
besties with Matt Gaetz, who is another person.
Congress does not let her on any committees. They don't let her do anything. She's just there taking up space. No one sits with her at lunch, in my opinion, and everyone hates her, in my opinion.
I agree with all those things. Those are correct to the extent that they are factually discernible. I should also say she's a huge gun person, mm-hmm. and she's also like besties with Matt Gaetz, who is another person you should Google if you don't know who he is. Suffice it to say, she doesn't look for the nuance in political arguments, much like this green coat lady who we encounter and who we will learn more about as this episode goes on.
And I have dubbed her Marjorie Taylor Greencoat because I imagine her political alignings are much of Marjorie Taylor Greene's. And also she, throughout the episode, wears a green coat and a green hat. It was cute. I liked it. It worked.
No, I liked it a lot. I just had her as green coat lady. So you've got me on that one.
So anyway, there's this whole thing going on with the Boston Ballet and Russian ballerinas are performing. And Jessica is actually going to the ballet.
Jessica is actually, she's watching this with a little bit of concern because she apparently has tickets to one of these shows and she doesn't want to not be able to go because of all this political turmoil that is going on with the ballet and presence of these Russian nationals in America during maybe not the height of the Cold War, but like we're definitely still in the thick because we're not Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, but we're not fall of the Iron Curtain yet either. She has some concerns that she's not going to make it to the ballet. So that's kind of where the scene ends.
And the next scene picks up with Jessica and then this older gentleman with a slender face. We learn later his name is Leo Peterson. I just call him Peterson. He's, you know, pretty vanilla. Jessica and Mr. Peterson are going to the ballet. They're kind of like at the front entrance or, you know, they're going through all the doors. And at a certain point, they're at one of the stops and there's this scary fat man with a beard. We learn later that he's Major Kosaroff or he's some major with the KGB. This major guy acknowledges Peterson. So we don't know at this point if they know each other or not.
On the way into the theater, they encounter another gentleman, Mr. Eddington, who is the president of the Arts Council. I have him down as just like a big old nerd. He's got, I think, curly hair. He's got glasses. He looks like he wouldn't win in any kind of fight, either physical or of wits. But he's nice enough. And I actually have Mr. Peterson down as handsome, age-appropriate man. And then a note that says that tweed coat, though.
Oh, yes.
So he is a well-dressed, handsome, age-appropriate man. He also appears to be of Russian extraction, but we find out more about that a little bit later. And in terms of the big, menacing fat guy with the beard, I just named him Major What's-His-Name because I mm-hmm. couldn't pronounce it and I gave up because I'm a quitter. Apparently, Mr. Eddington knows Mr. Peterson and appears to know Jessica. And this performance is actually, I think it's like a preview or like a sneak peek. It's not something that's like open to the public. This is like something that you had to be a special person to get tickets to, I think.
He hands him the playbill from the bottom of the stack of playbills. So, you know, Mr. Eddington is giving out these playbills, obviously, like anyone would, from the top down. So as someone's coming in, he's just handing them a playbill. But he gives Mr. Peterson's the playbill from the bottom of the deck.
we are backstage with a gentleman who I'm sure has a name, but I've nicknamed him Sweater Vest. And he is apparently the stage manager or something to that effect. He manages to be both really rude to his subordinates and also extremely sexually predatory towards the ballerinas. And he's not even subtle about it. Now, I'm not saying that there's any situation where being a sexual predator is okay, but he's just so comically obnoxious about it that it's just like an insult to injury situation. Like, he walks up to her and he starts making these really slimy comments. She's just this tiny blonde lady with big doe eyes, and she apparently seems to not know what's going on. And
she's one of the Russian ballerinas. Her name is Irina.
Yes. And while Sweater Vest is doing all kinds of terrible things and saying things, he's kind of getting stared down by this Russian thug, not to be confused with the one that we saw in the lobby of the theater. This is a guy, his name is Barinsky. He is either a KGB agent or former KGB agent who's like security for the ballerinas or the ballet troupe, and I guess to keep them safe from creeps like Sweater Vest.
A couple of notes I have. I call him Argyle Sweater. When he's like hitting on Irina, he's like touching her arms and he's pulling her against him, and he's definitely pushing his semi against her. And then the Barinsky, I named him KGB guy with hair, because did you notice his hair?
I didn't, but I feel like I should now that you've mentioned it.
I'm almost certain he was wearing a wig.
Oh, I can believe that. Absolutely. Like a proper wig, or do you think it was like a toupee? Because I heard toupees were pretty popular in the 80s.
I don't think it was a toupee because it went down the back of his neck.
Oh boy. Yeah, I'm going to have to go back and watch that.
As this scene was going on between Irina and Argyle Sweater, Barinsky, the KGB guy with hair, he comes and he breaks it up, and he's very aggressive and tells Argyle Sweater to stay away. Argyle Sweater is getting a lot of attitude back. And I was a little impressed at like how ballsy this guy was with a KGB agent, especially he's wearing an Argyle sweater. Like, simmer down, dude.
I get that. And this actually kind of leads me very early on into an issue that I wanted to discuss with you, was the question of how much power these guys actually have, the KGB guys or the security guys. And that might be Argyle Sweater is giving it back to him, but at the same time, he's also safe in his own country.
I don't know about
safe in quotation marks. But I guess there's something to be said of, and this is something that I was unfortunately like disabused of very recently, was feeling safe like in your own like neighborhood/comfort zone. And that might have been just he felt like maybe he was king of his castle and these guys were intruders, and it doesn't matter if they're bigger. He's an American, goddammit. Nobody's gonna need the freedom to sexually harass these women.
I just think for me, at any point, I'm always afraid of the KGB. I'm afraid of the KGB right now. I hope the KGB is not listening to this podcast. If you are, I'm very terrified of you. I personally would not have given any attitude back to the KGB, you know, whether I was surrounded by FBI agents or I'm scared for this man.
I guess my question is less to do is whether you should be afraid of ending up at the bottom of a river as how much jurisdiction the Soviet government would have in a situation like this. What's even the point of the KGB guys except to make sure that nobody runs away? It becomes like a big issue like later in the episode, so we can kind of table it until then, but I just kind of want to put that bug in your ear. After this confrontation, we follow Irina to a dressing room backstage where we meet two other Russian ballet dancers, Natalia and her husband, who I nicknamed Red Jumpsuit, and I know he has a name. You're going to have to tell me that name.
Alexander.
They're hugging and they're kind of speaking ominously in the dressing room. It kind of feels like something's about to happen.
So at this point, and it wasn't until like towards the very end of the episode, I didn't realize that Alexander and Natalia were married. I thought that they were brother and sister.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're not. They are married, but
yeah, they're definitely not
brother. I was confused.
I really was not.
So the ballet starts and Peterson looks in his playbill and Jessica sees the number 19 scribbled on one of the pages. And then it cuts to Marjorie Taylor Greencoat is like in the back alley. She's banging on one of the door, screaming rhetoric about commies. And then she kind of turns around to leave and she sees someone opening a window that's a couple of floors above.
And while this is going on, the ballet is going on, and we kind of keep getting shots to Peterson and Eddington. Eddington's skulking around in the back, so he's obviously like keeping an eye on something. And then Peterson kind of looks a little bit tense. So there's obviously something in the works here. Marjorie Taylor Greencoat makes it backstage and makes it onto stage where she interrupts the ballerinas. And she starts screaming about banning the ballet, commies, whatever. She doesn't seem to have a particularly coherent message other than commies are bad.
I don't think that there was too much of an argument at this point that commies weren't bad. I think that was pretty much probably the consensus of most of America.
This reminded me a little bit of like, you know how the Westboro Baptist Church used to like pick the most weirdly random things to protest?
I'm going to stop you right there. So the Westboro Baptist Church protest my high school.
Ooh, what did your high school do?
So my junior year, this girl that was a year below me was a lesbian, and she created the Gay Straight Alliance Club. So the Westboro Baptist Church heard about this. They came and they were on the other side of the road that our high school was on. It turned out to be not a big deal at all. You know, they just had their God hates fag signs and stuff, and that was fine. But the next year, I don't know if this was the superintendent, the school board, the principal, but whatever the school system decided that there would be no extracurricular clubs that were not academically related. So there was no Gay Straight Alliance Club. There was no Fellowship of Christian Athletes clubs. There was no community service clubs. So that was their way of cutting their nose off to spite their face. Marjorie Taylor Greencoat, she's, you know, run on stage screaming about the commies. Prior to her running on stage, Peterson gets up, like, kind of before the final act. He excuses himself and he just, like, disappears. Marjorie Taylor Greencoat is now screaming on the stage. And now Peterson comes back and he takes Jessica and he says, you know, we've got to leave immediately. But he's not taking her to the parking garage. Instead, he takes her to like this different parking lot. And there waiting is a beautiful Rolls Royce where Alexander is the driver and Natalia is sitting in the back seat. Prior to this, there was the finale curtain call of the ballet. And we see that Natalia and Alexander are not on stage. And this is alarming, especially alarming to all of the KGB people.
It all kind of happens at the same time. They don't show up on stage. Jess is being rushed out. There's general chaos. Major What's-His-Name is speaking into a walkie-talkie. In the space of, you know, a couple of minutes, Justice rushed out of the theater into this Rolls Royce, and surprise! Alexander is the chauffeur, and Natalia is sitting in the back seat. And then they just kind of drive away, leaving Jess to kind of try to figure out what the hell just happened.
At some point, like when Major What's-His-Face was on the radio, he tells Berensky, the KGB guy with the hair, to go check the dressing room. And then the Major What's-His-Face, he gets to the dressing room as soon as he can. But what he sees is Berensky is dead and he's stabbed in the back.
Turns out that Mr. Peterson is Natalia's uncle. He had defected from the Soviet Union, you know, I guess maybe 20 years or more beforehand. I think we learned that a little bit later. This had been a plan that had been in motion for several years for him to essentially rescue Natalia, and I guess Alexander eventually came along for the ride. Peterson had used Jessica essentially as his cover, as his date to go to the ballet, because he thought it would be strange for a single guy to go to the ballet by himself.
He's not wrong.
And this is a pattern we see a lot. And actually, it kind of has early hints of the age-appropriate James Bond that we get. Michael Haggerty, is that his name? Played by the great Len Carew, where Jess keeps getting dragged into international incidents without being warned or anything. If Peterson was planning this, couldn't he have brought somebody in on it who could have, because I feel like having a person who doesn't know what's going on is just too much of a variable in a situation like that.
I mean, it could definitely be dead weight, but also you kind of don't want her in on it, so that way she acts natural. Because if she knows what's going on or knows what's about to take place, her demeanor may be a little unnatural and forced and suspicious.
The original plan, it seems, was to have Alexander and Natalia turn themselves in and defect. But because KGB agent with the hair was found stabbed to death in his dressing room and that Natalia and Alexander are suspects, now there's a little bit of a snafu. And this is where I start to get confused about the jurisdiction issue. When they're talking in the car, there's like a last minute plan change where they have to go and hide Natalia and Alexander in Cabot Cove until they can prove that they weren't the murderers. Because if they were guilty of murder, then they'd be dragged back to the Soviet Union. To which I say, really? Question mark.
My understanding was they were going to, what do you call it? The national, like, convolute? What's that word?
The consulate? Like
consulate. Yes. And that is where you ask for asylum. Mm-hmm. But since now they are suspects in a murder, it's kind of like the clean hands doctrine, I guess. Like, you can't come and ask for asylum if, you know, you're suspected of murdering someone. Obviously, they would not be granted asylum at this point if they're murder suspects.
Let's assume worst case scenario, and they actually did kill this guy. Like, they killed him on U.S. soil, like within the jurisdiction of the U.S. government. Given the alarm with which they speak of Soviet justice, even in this situation, I almost feel like it would be preferable to turn yourself in to American cops and be like, hey, I'm under suspicion. Put me in American prison. Jesus Christ, don't send me home.
Yeah, that's a really good point that I didn't think of, because you're right there. The KGB is, you know, will continue to search for them in hopes of capturing them, taking them back to Russia, giving them a fair and just trial, and then murdering them. The KGB, Russia, whatever, may not have jurisdiction to take them back, but they probably do have the power. As in, they'll probably threaten Natalia and Alexander's family overseas or whatever.
Yeah, or some like chicken shit DA will agree to extradition or something.
Yeah.
Like that kind of thing. They decide that the place to hide two Russian people is in Cabot Cove. So along the way, Jess calls Ethan and tells him that she has these two Russian people, basically need to hide out in Cabot Cove for a few days. As we find out later, she does not tell him they're fugitives from justice. She has to do a lot of work to convince him that he should babysit these two ballet dancers for a couple of days while she does some investigating in Boston. I have been fortunate in my life to have a lot of friends, but I'm not sure I have any that would like agree to hide two Russian nationals. If you do, like, that's great. And, you know, I guess that must be a measure of friendship that I have yet to encounter.
Major What's-His-Face and this FBI guy are questioning Argyle Sweater. Jessica interrupts at one point and she asks, who's in charge here? And Major What's-His-Face immediately says, I am. And this pisses the FBI guy off. Then Jessica introduces herself. She mentions that she was in the audience earlier. And then Major What's-His-Face says, oh, yeah, you were with that distinguished looking gentleman. And she just kind of politely nods and says, oh, yes, he returned home. But I stayed because he doesn't have the fascination with murder that I do. And that piques everyone's interest. And she explains that she's a mystery writer. Major What's-His-Face kind of perks up and says, oh, well, you know, I've read a lot of novels by this female mystery writer. Major What's-His-Face is actually super charming. He's funny. Most of the time, he's very nice. He's very personable. And I think he kind of knows how to play the game.
Oh, I think so, too. And I think he's very much a party man, and he's had to probably cultivate this kind of affable but secretly insidious kind of thing. One thing that they do have a little bit of a disagreement about is when she, I think he maybe suggests that she come to the Soviet Union on like a book tour or whatever, and she makes a comment about how the Soviet government doesn't see fit to pay royalties. He dismisses that with a wave of his hand, saying royalties are just capitalist propaganda. And this becomes a little bit of an iteration throughout this. And it just almost seems a little bit lazy to me. To the Soviet Union's credit, their views were a little more nuanced than capitalism bad. Back in the dressing room, we're at the scene of the crime. Oh, I forgot to say, did you notice Agent O'Farrell, who's the FBI guy? Did you notice his suit?
No, I didn't.
It looks like it's like a size too big for him. And like he just got it out of a plastic wrapper because it is so wrinkled. They're in the dressing room looking at the crime scene. There's like a tape outline on the floor.
Which is one of my favorite things that I have seen yet in this entire 10 episodes is the tape outline on the floor of Brinsky's body.
They're just kind of like strolling over it and not giving a crap. I'm like, what's the point of having it there if you're just gonna,
I don't know,
walk around like touching everything? Like, this, I think this is another question that we had about like preserving crime scenes, so just letting people waltz on through them. Well, at least they made note of where the body was.
So. Yes, that's very well preserved now.
That's an improvement. Major What's-His-Name has come up with the theory of a crime. He has decided that Alexander stabbed KGB with the hair with the jeweled dagger that he had used as a prop in one of the scenes. And Jessica throws it back at him. And I think the purpose of the scene was to show that A, she's not afraid of him, and B, she is independently evaluating. Meanwhile, like, wrinkled paper bag over here isn't saying anything. He just kind of lets Major What's-His-Name push him around.
Major What's-His-Face, his theory was, okay, Natalia and Alexander are trying to escape. But then Brinsky comes in and sees what they're doing. So there's a struggle between Natalia and Brinsky because Brinsky has like fingernail scratches on his face. And during that struggle, Alexander grabs a dagger and stabs him in the back. Jessica's like, you know, I mean, that's, you know, pretty, I could get on board with that. But also, I think that there's another suspect, and that, you know, Major's like, well, who would that be? And she says, it's you. You're the first person that came on Brinsky's body. It seems to me that maybe you realized Alexander and Natalia were defecting. And by murdering Brinsky, you could thwart that plan because now they can't seek asylum if they are murder suspects.
We're in Jessica's hotel in the next scene, and she's talking on the phone to Ethan. By this point, he's figured out that the Russian young people that he is hiding are fugitives from justice. And he has this really funny line.
All right, but I'm only doing it for you. There is no room on my boat for international politics.
At this point, like, he's basically in an impossible situation, right? Because he's already kind of complicit. But
yeah,
he also didn't know. But it's also one of those situations where he had to have known something was going on.
But it's funny because you and I just talked about how Jessica finds herself in impossible situations that other people put her in. But Jessica also puts other people in impossible situations like this several times as well.
There's this really aggressive knocking at her door. Surprise, it is Major What's-His-Name.
So that scene is really, I think, a transition scene because he invites Jessica to go to the police station because okay. You know, they've gotten some preliminary reports. So they go to the police station and the FBI agents, the cops are going through Berensky's items. Someone mentions, or I think Jessica has a report, and it says that in Berensky's pocket was a handkerchief with his own blood on it. And that therefore disproves Major What's-His-Face's theory that Berensky was murdered during a struggle between Natalia and Alexander. That whole point was kind of made that, okay, so if Natalia and Berensky are struggling and Natalia scratches Berensky's face, Berensky isn't going to take the time to, you know, take a handkerchief out of his pocket, wipe his face, and then put the handkerchief back in his pocket, only then to be stabbed in the back by Alexander. Like, none of that makes sense. Kind of obvious and apparent here that there wasn't this struggle between Natalia and Berensky and Alexander.
Well, they also indicate that there were green fibers which were stuck in Berensky's watch band. And Jessica points out that Marjorie Taylor Greencoat had been wearing a green, I think she calls it a green sweater, though I thought it was a coat, and we're going to keep calling her Greencoat because that's a cool name. Uh-huh. Now that kind of points towards her as a suspect. While all this is happening, Major What's-His-Face is kind of pitching book ideas to her. He's doing basically the equivalent of, I'm a writer too.
Yeah, so that was like the next scene, which again was kind of like a transition scene where they're both on the elevator in the hotel. Major What's-His-Face is being super charming and yeah, just like giving her all of these novel ideas, and he could be kind of the leading lad of the novel. And then that's where he asks her for a nightcap, and she says, oh, it's too late, but definitely want a rain check. Then Major What's-His-Face gets off the elevator on his floor, and Jessica's about to push the button to her floor, but then has a change of heart, and I think she pushes like the lobby button.
That leads us to her confronting Mr. Eddington, and this must be right after, so mm-hmm. She probably goes to see him. I wasn't quite sure about whether it was the next day or the same night or whatever. He is wearing a bright red jacket and he is pacing around a well-appointed study. He is explaining to Jessica the plan. Eddington's father actually arranged for Mr. Peterson's defection, I guess, you know, 20 odd years earlier. And Mr. Peterson himself had been a ballet dancer, been crushed by a falling stage light, and he couldn't dance. Eddington also admitted that Peterson was the one who had opened the window into the alley that Marjorie Taylor Greencoat had seen. And then he also said that KGB with the hair had seen Eddington in the music room, and that Eddington noticed when he saw KGB that his face was bleeding from scratches.
Eddington's part in this defection for Natalia and Alexander, he was to open the window so that Peterson could sneak in through the window and drop off some change of clothes for Natalia and Alexander in the locker room, locker number 19. And that was pretty much Eddington's role.
We see after this, Jess is walking back to her hotel. It's cutting back and forth between her and a guy in a fedora who appears to be following her. And there's really never a good situation in which someone is being followed by a man in a fedora. Like, just as a general rule, even if it's, you know, they're ostensibly non-threatening, like, come on, guys. Like, you know, you're not in the rat pack.
Yeah. Fedoras don't bring good news.
No, most certainly not. Unless you're like an adorable old man, then you can wear one. That's like the only exception, is adorable old men, because they're like grandfathered in. Rim shot. The music gets faster, things get quicker, and all of a sudden, fedora guy costs her, and then a car pulls up, and out bursts Major What's-His-Face. And it appears that Fedora was a bodyguard who was assigned by Major What's-His-Face to follow her to make sure she was okay. Major What's-His-Name tells Jessica that Marjorie Taylor Greencoat has been arrested for KGB's murder, and that, oh, look, suddenly Natalia and Alexander are off the hook, and you should totally tell me where they are.
What I thought was funny about this scene is right when Jessica is leaving Mr. Eddington's place, he's really concerned about her safety because apparently Boston, like Maryland, is very dangerous and sketchy at night. But she insists she's fine. She's going to walk. Yeah, so it's very apparent she's being followed. She speeds up. Fedora dude speeds up. She slows down. Fedora dude slows down. So what she does, I think, is pretty funny. Is at one point, I think she like turns a corner and then really quickly she hides in like a stairwell of a stoop. So then this fedora KGB guy runs past her and then she steps down off the stoop behind him. She's bested this KGB agent. And that's when Major What's-His-Face pulls up and he sees that his KGB officer has been bested by an old lady.
Shame on you. That's why the Soviet Union fell, because stuff like this. We're in Cabot Cove, and this has probably got to be one of the funniest scenes that we've seen to date.
Absolutely. One of the best.
It has several things going for it. The first is that it involves Amos, which is always funny. Uh-huh. But it also involves the Amos and Ethan dynamic, which is also funny, which is another layer of funny. But it also involves like another layer of physical comedy with these Russians. So what happens is Amos is downtown Cabot Cove looking for Ethan, and he runs into Alexander on the boat, who is trying so very hard not to be Russian.
He could say yep and nope.
He does say them in like a Maine type, like he appears to have picked up the dialect. So he can only answer yes and no questions. Amos isn't really getting the message, and he doesn't realize, I guess, coincidence that these people are missing, and then two random people show up in his town. And then he sees Ethan, and Ethan is like, who the fuck are you talking to? And Ethan's obviously alarmed.
Amos is like, oh, that new deckhand you have, he's mighty nice. And then Ethan says he gabs too much for me, which is funny because all he can say is yep and no. Amos goes on about how they think that two of these Ruski dancers might be hiding in Cabot Cove. And then Ethan is playing dumb very well here.
I don't know if I'd know a Russian if I saw one, would you?
From a country mile away.
Amos is basically here for comic relief, but that scene was just so well played.
Next scene is Jessica and Major What's-His-Face having breakfast at the hotel. They're talking about Marjorie Taylor Greencoat. Apparently, she's not talking or cooperating with the investigation. But Major What's-His-Face believes that she stabbed Berensky and then ran onto the stage to cause a disturbance. Jessica isn't really sure that this is the case. She's kind of confused about the murder weapon. And then there's just kind of this weird part of the scene where Jessica sees three of the other ballet dancers from the company.
I thought that exchange was really strange as well, because and I feel like this is another situation with and Amelia coming back to, yeah, see, she's so mousy and nondescript that I forgot her name. I'm like, that lady, the one with the thing and the stuff. And I just feel like this is just of being reminded that Irina is a character, because up until this point, the only time we had seen her was at the beginning when she's getting sexually harassed. And then I think we maybe see her a little bit afterward, but she's not in any of the intervening scenes. Jessica lets Major What's-His-Face know that she's going back to Cabot Cove, and that's kind of the end of the scene. And you know, Irina doesn't, and her friends don't leave. They're just kind of sitting there.
Yeah. No, Jessica says she's going to catch the next bus back to Cabot Cove, and then that stupid KGB guy, the idiot one, he comes over and tells Major What's-His-Face that Marjorie Taylor Greencoat has decided to talk.
How much do you want to bet that Marjorie Taylor Greencoat really, really, really knows her constitutional rights? The type who is like, she's been arrested hundreds of times. She can rattle off her First Amendment rights.
Oh, man. I didn't know if you were like being serious that she actually knows her constitutional rights, or no, if it's, you know, more
people who have like been in situations like that before, like who have quote been through the system, are like, and it's like a hyper specific knowledge and practical application. And I imagine she's the type of person who's like, I'm waiting for my lawyer. You can't talk to me for all these constitutional reasons. And
I am, in my mind, so I'm a member of a couple of Facebook groups from like my hometown, and it's the Concerned Citizens of, you know, blah, blah, blah. And oh my God, I should like send you screenshots, because now all of a sudden the entire county are HIPAA attorneys. And when I say HIPAA, I mean HIPPA, because that's how they spell it. And trust me, they know their HIPAA right.
Oh, with the masks and stuff?
With the mask.
Oh, they don't have to wear masks because of HIPAA. Yeah,
that and their employer has no right to ask to see their vaccination card, because that's a violation of their rights. I think I may have discovered a continuity error.
Oh, in this show?
And I'll explain this after I set up the scene. So Jessica is getting off the bus, and she's greeted by Amos. And Amos is kind of like asking about the murder that happened in Boston. And she's explaining, you know, it's open and shut. Marjorie Taylor Greencoat did it. And Jessica asks where Ethan is. And Amos says, oh, he's on his deck showing the new deckhand the ropes. And then we see like Jessica like taking off running or speed walking or whatever it is that she does to the docks and finds Ethan. And Ethan is like, you know, I'm hiding them in plain sight, which apparently is kind of the best thing to do when you've got Sheriff Amos Tupper around. And then he cracks a joke and he says he thinks that Natalia is a Swede from Minnesota. And then Jessica goes on to explain like, okay, well, I'm taking Natalia with me. You need to bring Alexander over for supper tonight. We've got to come up with a plan, because this town's about to be swarming with the KGB, the FBI. Continuity error. Back to the episode with the driverless car. Do you remember when one of the business partners, he gets off of a boat? So he takes a boat into Cabot Cove, and he's asking Ethan where the taxis are. And Ethan is saying, oh, the taxis stay where the train station is, which is a couple miles away. Well, do you think that the train station and the bus stop are probably at the same place?
Considering Cabot Cove isn't much of a town, I would think they would at least be within spitting distance of each other, but it wouldn't make sense for them to be the same place.
If Jessica is getting off the bus and then she runs to the docks where Ethan is, then the bus stop is essentially at the docks.
How do you know she just didn't run a whole mile or 2 miles?
You know, it is Jessica Fletcher, so it's very possible.
We should always sit down and draw like our own map of Cabot Cove to see if it bends space and time. I think you're right. I think.
Yeah. Anyway, that's just what I picked up on.
No, that was a good catch. That was a good catch. I didn't even think about it. After we thwart the laws of physics, we go to dinner at Jess's house. And it is Mr. Peterson, Natalia, Alexander, Ethan, and Jess. Looks like they're having chowder, but I just assume that that's what they have for every meal.
I made a comment that we should totally create a Murder, She Wrote cookbook.
Ooh, I feel like there might already be one, but I think, no, that's a good idea. We can make clam dip. Do you know how to cook anything?
Uh-huh. Oh, we need to, hold on. We need to copyright this and trademark this and register it right now. We've got to get all of the intellectual property things. We pretty much set it. So I think that's the same thing.
Yeah. And I'll like set up so an no LLC one can steal for us to put all the money through. I have to check like the US Patent and Copyright Office to make sure that it hasn't already been taken. And also we can probably expect a lawsuit from like, you know, well, hey, if we get her attention, you know, there's no such thing as bad attention. We can just be like, oh, you sued us. You must know we exist. All of a sudden the doorbell rings, which is probably the last fucking thing you want to hear whenever you're harboring fugitives at your house.
And then I have a note that says the Russians scatter like cockroaches.
They do. They're like, take them upstairs, hide. I was like, okay, first of all, if you're trying to hide people, like keep them in disparate locations. So don't just like put everybody together. There's this guy at the door, but it's this, you know, kind of sailor guy. I nicknamed him Fake Maine Accent. He comes in and he starts.
Well, it's like a 1920s accent.
Does anybody in this whole show know what a Maine accent actually sounds like?
No, because Ethan and Amos sound Southern half the time.
That's true. Amos's family is actually from Kentucky, we learn much later. So maybe that's why. I think I'm giving too much credit. He comes in, this guy, this blonde guy wearing sailor clothes comes in and says, oh, I'm looking for Captain Craig. That's Ethan. He yaks off a bunch of boat jargon, which even though I am a boat expert, I was only able to figure out from context. Basically, he's looking for a boat part, supposedly. And Ethan's like, oh, I don't have it, but old Steve or something has it. Fake Maine accent is like, oh, can I use your phone? So Jess says, you know, you can use the one in the kitchen. He goes in there. And while they're walking in, she asks him,
you from down east, Mr. Johnson?
Oh, no, ma'am. I'm from Maine. Born and bred up near Bar Harbor.
And that's supposed to set off alarm bells everywhere because I didn't know what that meant, but I still knew that it meant something whenever I first. So he supposedly gets on the phone. She goes out into the living room while he's making his phone call. The ballet's on the news again. And then this guy who had called, who said his name is Dewey Johnson, you know, says, oh, I'm going to go see old Steve. See you later. And walks out the door.
This guy, Dewey Johnson, with a 1920s accent, he leaves and the Russians come back from their hiding place and she tells Ethan that he's not who he says he is because when she asked him if he was from down east, he said no. He actually, in his 1920s accent, he said, nah, I'm from Bar Harbor, born and bred.
Fun fact, actually, apparently the term down east, while it does refer to Maine, it does not refer to all of Maine.
Interesting.
He would have been able to, theoretically, any Mainer would have been able to recognize down east as a term. So, you know, it still kind of checks out. But at the same time, I don't think every Mainer is a down easter, but I could be wrong. So I will find out.
Here's kind of my issue with this scene. So this Dewey Johnson character shows up because he heard Ethan Craig was there and he wants to buy this spare part, which what I can tell from context clues seems to be like a spare tire for the boat. So we're going to go with that. He's wanting to buy this spare tire. So he just shows up because he heard that Ethan Craig was there. When Ethan says, oh no, I don't have the spare tire, you should call, you know, old Steve in Rockwater Bay, or you should go see old Steve in Rockwater Bay. He gets the bright idea, oh, well, maybe I should call old Steve first to see if he has that part.
Versus showing up unannounced at a stranger's house to confront somebody in the middle of dinner.
But well, I don't know.
At least he learned manners, even if it was a little bit too late.
Yeah. Jessica figures out that he's not who he says he is and thinks that her phone is now bugged.
Well, the important thing is that she lets him bug her phone Because she knows ahead of time that he's up to something, but rather than her saying, like, you're full of shit, get out of my house, she lets him.
At first, you don't realize that it is the FBI that's bugging her phone. I thought that they maybe got, like, another KGB agent to bug the phone, but it is FBI that we later find out. In order for the FBI or any government agency to bug your phone, they have to have a warrant, I guess, unless it falls under the Patriot Act, which I'm not sure this does.
FISA warrant to do a wiretap, because that's something slightly different.
But you still have to have some kind of probable cause, right?
FISA has come, and it stands for Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978. If there's any issue with, like, foreign spies, or you think there's espionage or something, it's like an ex parte court, and the standard of probable cause is, like, really, really low. And it's actually come under a lot of scrutiny in the past 10 or 15 years, especially since the Patriot Act, you know, really actually made it much, much worse. If you want to feel a little bit more terrible about losing due process or your constitutional rights, I would recommend reading about FISA warrants. So super fun.
We're going to mask our actual violation of constitutional rights with the term patriot. So then it's all good. People aren't going to know.
Apropos of phone talk, we get to see our friend Letitia again. And by see, I mean not see, but she is referred to because Jessica is talking to her on the phone. She's trying to make a phone call to Boston, but she gets interrupted because somebody is at the door. Who is at the door, Laura?
Well, again, we hear the pounding, pound, pound, pound. And she opens the door and it's Amos. And it's Major What's-His-Face. And I think there's a couple other deputies. And this time they have brought a warrant to search the premises. Major What's-His-Face is kind of apologetic, but he explains that he's looking for Alexander and Natalia. And they've already searched Mr. Peterson's house, but no one was there. And Jessica's kind of playing dumb. And Major What's-His-Face says, well, Marjorie Taylor Greencoat is finally talking. She said that she did struggle with Berensky and she scratched his face as she was being thrown out of that back alley. But then she discovered the open window to the musician's room. So she climbed into that. And when she was in the musician's room, she heard a sound and hid. And at that point, she watched Mr. Peterson climb through the open window, and he had a viola case with him that contained two costumes, and he hid in a locker. Major What's-His-Face goes on to explain who Mr. Peterson really is, what his real name was, that he was a defector from Soviet Union 20 years ago, and that he is Natalia's great uncle.
I have a quick logistics question. So this guy is no spring chicken. He's like probably got to be at least in his mid-50s, early 60s, and he has a limp that keeps getting repeatedly pointed out. I can't crawl through that window, and I like to think I'm in pretty good shape. And existential crisis aside, like, I'm still pretty youngish. Like, how does, like, a 60 something like crippled guy get through a window? And just a question to chew on.
I did not even think about that, because it was at least the second story. I think it might have even been the third story.
Is he like a cat burglar in his spare time?
Yeah, I didn't see any like ladders or anything, but Marjorie Taylor Greencoat managed to get through the same window. So it's possible.
She's in shape from running away from the police. So
And she has the QAnon powers.
Yes. Amos goes to help search the house, and by search the house, he means I'm going to go check in the kitchen, which I thought was really funny. And Amos comes out.
There's no one in the kitchen.
Well, I could have told you that, Amos. How did you enjoy the muffin?
Real good, ma'am.
What's-His-Face makes a bunch of, like, ominous Russian threats, and then they leave because they haven't found anything.
Major What's-His-Face is like trying to convince Jessica to tell him where they're hiding, and he promises Jessica that they will get a fair and just trial in Russia. And then at that point, Peterson steps in the house and says, yeah, and then they will be executed. And then Peterson goes on and says, you know, I'm going to confess. And then he, you know, confesses to killing Berensky so that Natalia and Alexander could escape. And Jessica's upset about this. She says, Major, you know that he's lying. Major What's-His-Face says, yeah, arrest him anyway. And then as Major What's-His-Face is leaving, he stops being so cute and charming and really threatens Jessica and angrily says, don't be deceived by my gentle manner.
Taking away even that whole monologue that I had on jurisdiction, it sounds like Major What's-His-Face is basically trying to get Leo back to Russia. Because if he's trying to direct the FBI, he should have like no say in this point. Because this is an American citizen, ostensibly. They're not going to extradite an American citizen into a foreign country for a crime that committed on American soil. Like that's
right.
I have a note that says, bro, this isn't even your country. Cool it.
When we first started the scene, Jessica was on the phone with Letitia. The scene's almost over after Major What's-His-Face makes these really scary threats to Jessica. Then Jessica goes back to her phone, calls Letitia back up and says, okay, make that call to Boston now.
Dewey Johnson is listening on a boat. And he is tapping this call where Jessica has made a call to Irina, the blonde ballerina that we saw like in three scenes. And she basically is giving her an update, knowing that she's being tapped, saying Alexander and Natalia are safe. Alexander says this to you. And she says something in Russian, which she says she doesn't understand.
Я буду любить тебя. I hope I said it correctly. I don't know what it means.
Fun fact, which I told you about, is that while I was watching this with my parents, in addition to like being proficient in French, my dad also speaks Russian. He was sitting there and he's like squinting at the screen and he's just kind of listening and he like translated it in real time. And I'm like, wow, they went through the trouble of having actual Russian in there. So like it withstands the scrutiny of my, you know, baby boomer father who decided to learn Russian as a hobby because he was bored in the 90s.
Have you ever thought that maybe your dad is a retired CIA agent?
He's not smooth enough to do it. He does not have the grace. Yeah. I love him, but he is the most awkward dude in the entire world.
Maybe he just wants you to think he's awkward.
Well, he does know German too, so those were all
He's definitely in the CIA. Jessica delivers this message to Irina in Russian. Irina is very excited about the message, and Irina says she really wants to be there, and Jessica suggests that she asks Argyle Sweater for his help. Jessica leaves her house. She goes out jogging in her little jogging gray suit, and then that's where we see the stupid KGB guy because he's spying in the bushes. Amos is giving Major What's-His-Face the verbal runaround.
Now, here's a possibility. The old Lindemann farmhouse been deserted since 68.
Well, let's go there at once.
Oh. Just remember, the whole place burned to the ground last winter, lock, stock, and barrel.
Major What's-His-Face is getting super pissed. And then this stupid KGB guy comes into the sheriff's office and he's like, I lost Jessica Fletcher. And then Amos just laughs.
They also find out in this scene that Irina has also fled the coop and slipped her guards at the ballet. And this apparently... This becomes obvious in the next scene because we see her in a car with Sweater Vest or Argyle Sweater. How long do you think he was in the car before he figured out this wasn't a date?
I would say with his intelligence, an hour and a half.
Yeah, that's actually pretty fair. But like, I don't like him at all. I think he's a piece of shit. but I gotta feel bad for a guy who's likely driving a woman to meet another guy. Like, that's just like, that's just like a level of just, oh honey, that I can't even.
She totally works him, and it's so funny.
Anyway, they pull up right outside Jessica's house. They go to the doorbell. Jessica's kind of minding her own business, supposedly typing away. This is where she says she has to make a phone call, and she runs into the kitchen and they ask her, well, what's wrong with the phone in the living room? She says,
well, that phone isn't bugged.
Jess goes to the kitchen and she calls Ethan. And again, we see that Dewey Johnson guy, he intercepts the call. And Jessica tells Ethan to take Natalia and Alexander to his boat and we'll meet you there. And then Dewey Johnson, FBI agent guy, calls his boss, which is like the original FBI guy. Jessica is pouring Irina tea and Irina's like, oh, I wonder what's taking Alexander and Natalia so long to get here. And then meanwhile, Argyle Sweater is like pacing around and he's pissed because he's clearly not going to be getting laid tonight. And he wants to leave, but Jessica tells him he should probably stay. It's safer that way because they're watching the house.
While they're having tea, Amos comes in with Major What's-His-Name and Irina panic.
At this point, they don't accuse her of murdering, but they accuse her of like harboring a murderer. And that's when she goes in to say that Alexander wasn't a murderer. Argyle Sweater guy is the murderer.
It turns out that there was kind of, I wouldn't even call it a love triangle. It's just more like a woman scorn type situation. Because Irina and Alexander had been together and then either they broke up and then he met Natalia, or they broke up because he met Natalia. But either way, she's basically had to watch the man she loved get married to another woman right in front of her face and had to pretend that like it was okay. Jessica goes into a little bit of exposition as to why she called everybody there. And she had mentioned that when she watched like a rerun or a tape of the ballet, she noticed that at the curtain call, not only were Natalia and Alexander missing, but Irina was missing too. It turns out, and this is at some point Irina again just spills the beans, that she killed KGB because he discovered that Alexander and Natalia had run away. I guess she killed him to prevent him from pursuing or from informing anybody that Alexander and Natalia had run away.
Do you remember back at the scene where we saw Berensky's tape outline on the floor and Major What's-His-Face was saying, well, obviously Alexander killed Berensky during a struggle so they could escape. And then Jessica said, or you killed Berensky because you saw that Alexander and Natalia had already escaped and you wanted to prevent them from defecting and seeking asylum. So you killed Berensky to make them a murder suspect. Well, that's essentially what Irina did, is she saw that Alexander and Natalia had escaped and killed Berensky as, like Jessica said, a way to thwart their plan.
This is not really a happy ending for anybody, because this is a situation I feel like where Irina is like a combination of victim and aggressor, because she wasn't in a good situation to begin with. I feel like maybe she kind of lost her marbles and acted out. Obviously, that doesn't excuse her behavior, but it kind of puts her in a more sympathetic light than it does like some other perpetrators that we've seen and that we will see. I have a note here that says, but at least she's going to American prison, ?
I think this kind of answers the jurisdictional question, because like when Irina's confessing, and you can like see Jessica Fletcher, she's concerned and she's sad and she feels very sorry for Irina. And after Irina confesses, she looks up at Major What's-His-Face with, you know, tears in her eyes. And she says, okay, take me back. And then this kind of breaks my heart a little bit, but Jessica says, child, Major What's-His-Face has no jurisdiction here. And then she tells Amos to be gentle with Irina. Now it's apparently apparent.
So now that she's going to American prison, Major What's-His-Name is going to go home. And Jessica and him have this kind of little like pleasant exchange where he's back to being charming. And she asks him about staying a couple of days. And he says a couple of days has a habit of turning into forever or something to that effect. And she's basically at this point kind of taking his temperature to see, I'm like, are you really like as red as you say you are? Like, are you really like a true believer? Or is this something that would you theoretically be tempted by like Western indulgence or what have you? And he kind of winks at her almost, and he just kind of lets the idea pass and just he's going back to his old life.
I can't imagine that with him being a KGB agent or whatever he was, he would have been granted any kind of asylum or refugee status.
But we grant asylum to like political, we granted asylum to like friggin' Nazi scientists because they had useful information, helped us make the bomb. If he had intel or intel like stuff that they could theoretically use in their Cold War dance, I'd say he'd actually be probably a better candidate for defection than a couple ballet dancers.
That's a good point, but also I would imagine he would be scared shitless.
You've seen Inglourious Bastards, right?
I haven't.
Well, basically at the end of it, the ultra icky villain, I don't know if I'm gonna spoil this, spoiler alert for, you know, this 12-year-old movie, the big nasty villain at the end like makes it so that he gets to get asylum in the US because he made a deal. They basically made a deal with the devil to save somebody. And Brad Pitt's character, who is what he was like leading the troop of like the guerrillas who killed people with bats, carves a swastika into his forehead. It's a Quentin Tarantino movie, so it's pretty gnarly. But he carves a swastika into his forehead as if to say, yeah, you might have asylum, but everybody still knows you're a Nazi. Laura, did you like this episode and did you have a golden Grady?
So yes, I did like this episode. It was very interesting. I was on the edge of my seat. Here's what I didn't like is this episode did not like give you enough information, I think, for you to figure out who the actual killer was, unless maybe you knew Russian. And also unless you'd seen this ballet before and knew the symmetry of the ballerinas. So I was a little irritated that I wasn't given enough information to figure the killer out. But with that being said, I did enjoy it. I give it 6 ashtrays. We'll make it 7 ashtrays because it was really good. I am giving the Golden Grady Award to the idiot KGB officer who is just bested again and again by Jessica Fletcher.
Solid choice. I can definitely see, like, if Grady were a KGB officer, that he would do something like that. First of all, I sent Laura a picture of, I was antiquing while I was at my parents' house. I stumbled upon the mother load of vintage ashtrays at this one antique mall we were at, and it was insane. How would you describe it?
So at first I thought you sent me like a wall of plate and I couldn't understand. And then I zoomed in on the picture. Like, I saw like one of the ashtrays had like a holder for your cigarette. So that way, like, you could set your cigarette down. And then that's when I realized it was ashtrays. And I'm like, oh my God, where are you? Is this heaven?
Not heaven. It is an antique mall in Millerstown, Pennsylvania. So if you're ever
looking, not even close, trade, really.
Yeah, we don't even have like a song pretending that state is almost heaven.
What are your thoughts on this episode? And who do you feel deserves the Golden Grady Award?
So I give it like maybe 6.5 ashtrays. It's like the Amelia problem, right? It's almost like, okay, the mailman showing up to kill somebody in the last scene. Like, it's like this character who doesn't really have a part in this, who's just like kind of in the background and shows up like every once in a while to be like, hey, look, Irina. I wish they would have incorporated her more into the story. Then it could be like less, it would have been less glaring whenever she did show up to be like, oh, look at this character. No reason. Just look at her. And kind of in the same vein as your Golden Grady, like I give my Golden Grady to Dewey Johnson because he's Grady. If Grady were an FBI agent. Because like he didn't even bother to do basic research before he showed up to be a super spy. Or like he got really into the boat stuff, but neglected to figure out regional sayings for things that might come up in conversation. It is ridiculous. Right.
And why is he from the 1920s?
I do not know. I'm going to just briefly discuss the next episode and then we will say adieu until August, which is... The next episode is called, it's season one, episode 11, and it's called Death Casts a Spell.
Ooh.
And the synopsis is that a popular nightclub hypnotist is discovered murdered during a private press call. Mm. And I'm just going to let you know that I already watched this because my mom wanted to watch it. And I have so many opinions that I'm going to have to sit on for a month. So,
oh, wow.
Like, let's just say there's a leisure suit involved and I just can't. So thank you all for listening to us again and for listening to us for the 10th time, apparently. So
bless your heart.
Yeah. Bless your heart. See, I'm not Southern, so I can't say that with the same kind.
No, it sounds really bad when you say it.
We will be back in August. And until then, like, share, and subscribe. Tell all your friends. Tell your enemies. With all that being said, like, have a great day. Have a great month. And stay woke.
Stay woke.